live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, carrots can reduce prostate cancer by 20%. Honeydew melons play a role in boosting your brain health and lowering blood pressure. Thyme oil beats ibuprofen for relieving menstrual pain. Why you need olive oil in your salad every day. And a separate article on olive oil supplements against advanced vascular effects of air pollution, plus a lot more on health and healing. My guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Beatrice Edwards. She is the executive director and an international program director for the Government Accountability Project, which works with whistleblowers from government, private corporations, and international financial institutions about corruption, accountability. We're going to talk about the rise of the illegal corporate security state and the threats it imposes on democracy and civil rights. Hence, I'm doing commentaries today, one from Professor Paul Craig Roberts on this topic about militarist bunk, how we got it all wrong. Very interesting. Then from Mr. Escobar, who's pivoting where in Eurasia? We're going to talk about where do we spend our money? What do we get for it? Why isn't any of it ever accountable? And just imagine what we could do if we stop wasting it. From our environmental segment today, leaked trade documents portends that the U.S. and European Union, a fracking bonanza. As written right now, secretive trade agreements would push industry-friendly protections for gas and oil out the door. And this is no different than Trans-Pacific Partnership. In fact, I'll be sharing insights on new revelations about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's another upward transfer of wealth. Also, the New York Times today has, if you're looking here, this is the Science Times section, the entire front of the page. The big melt accelerates, and it shows a picture of the world, and it says, quote, "The West Antarctic ice sheet isn't alone. Around the world, glaciers are steadily dripping away, raising sea levels." And then it shows you from the Himalayas to Alaska to Mongolia, Tibet, all these places that we have not paid attention to. And we should, because it's all going in the water, and it's going in now at what I've been saying. In fact, I've been saying it for 7 years. No one right now can give you any guarantee of when the first big glacier will break and slide in. It could be in a year or 100 years, but it's going to happen. It cannot be reversed. Nothing we're going to do now is going to stop it. This is one of the 30 tipping points, but four of the tipping points have tipped. We can't change that. So what do we need to know about it? I'll give you the latest on that. If time permits, a commentary from Mike Adams from Natural News, refreshing rationality, why not believing in conspiracies is a sure sign of mental condition. And then he goes into great depth about actual conspiracies on a daily basis, and yet people will say, oh, you're one of those conspiracy nuts. They're everywhere, right in front of us, and yet bring up the idea that we have been given misinformation on genetic engineering of our foods, and they'll say, oh, conspiracy. Or that there's over 1,300 scientists, physicists, and architects who say that the official version of the events 9/11 cannot be supported. They're wrong. Conspiracy theorist. No. Willing to challenge orthodoxy. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Carrots are important. When I first came to New York City, there was only one little health food store on the Upper West Side. And there was a gentleman in there who wore a white coat. He never smiled. He had a very limited juice menu, carrot and apple juice. That was it. You could either get carrot, apple, or carrot and apple. And of course, if you just take pure carrot juice, you're liable to get a sugar rush, and even natural, that's too much, can bump up your glycemic level. But he swore by it. Now, he said the carrots are so important to us, but we did not have all the data at that time on phytonutrients. It was almost impossible to get organic produce. But there were very low potency vitamins. A high potency vitamin at the time that was considered controversial was 5 milligrams of B-complex. Could you imagine? 5 milligrams? Today, it's not unusual to take 50, 100 milligrams, and the scientific literature even supports higher, depending upon what you're trying to do with it. So a long time from where I was when I came to the city to now in knowledge of health. This is the latest on carrots, and while they're really good for you. Quote, carrots can reduce prostate cancer risk by nearly 20%. And when you consider how many men will develop prostate cancer, about 233,000 new cases this year, almost 30,000 will die from it. That's 1 in 7 men at some point are going to end up with prostate cancer. Completely preventable. And what they found was when they did this study is that beta carotenoids and beta carotene, quote, we found a significant decreased risk of prostate cancer associated with high intake of carrots. And then it goes on to explain what's in the carrot that helps you. So I'm not going to suggest carrot juice. I'm going to suggest eating carrots, because when you eat the carrot, you don't have the spike in your blood sugar, yet you still get the benefit. If you don't like eating carrots, then steam them. And they're excellent that way. Most people don't eat honeydews. They're very good. A little tricky in that sometimes they're harvested when they're not ripe yet, ripe on the vine. And you can tell when they're ripe because you push your thumb on and it leaves a little tiny imprint. But if it doesn't move, it's not going to get ripe. And so when people buy them, get them home, open up, they're very, almost like cardboard. So that's why I guess a lot of people have had bad experience, they don't buy them. However, here's the latest report on honeydew melons, which is mildly sweet and easy to juice, throw into a blender. It helps with weight control. It helps fight colds. It helps regulate blood pressure. In fact, there was a study at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center showing that honeydews are rich in potassium and help reduce salt retention, therefore better control blood pressure. Also, it better balances the ratio of water to potassium, and that's good. That helps with blood pressure. It helps with the nervous system. Contains the B-complex, niacin, thiamine. And we know that the B-complex is important to boost brain health and prevent detrimental changes such as the onset of Alzheimer's. So our fruit of the day is honeydew melons. This time of year, easy to get. Thyme oil. This is an essential oil, and some research at Babel University Medical Sciences found that it's great for relieving pain, especially menstrual pain, more so than ibuprofen. They researched a group of women, university students, and who were having difficult menstruation, and they found that the women between 18 and 24 were suffering from dysmenorrhea. And by the way, primary dysmenorrhea is usually defined as a painful cramping that may or may not come with other symptoms like backache and nausea and headache and dizziness. And secondary dysmenorrhea usually indicates you're having a specific pain at the time of your period with some other condition. So they gave them 200 milligrams of ibuprofen and or a placebo, and then they gave them the drops, the time drops, or a placebo. and they found that there was substantial benefit in the group that received the thyme. So thyme oil, for those of you who want to deal with the pain of menstruation. Everyone I know who has a salad generally has extra virgin cold press olive oil on it. This is from King's College London, published in the PNAS Scientific Journal. It says that it has the ability to reduce blood pressure. And by the way, as do nuts, raw nuts, and avocados, spinach and celery also. And when these foods are combined, let's say you have a salad. So you have celery, carrots, spinach, some almonds, walnuts, pine nuts, avocado, put olive oil, apple cider vinegar, or mustard, or some dressing you can make up and put on it. That is extremely rich in natural nitrates. That helps facilitate better circulation and also the formation of nitrofatty acids. This was done by the British Heart Foundation, and they found that it made a difference. So if you want to have a healthier heart, have olive oil on your salad and have one minimal per day. It can help eliminate, quote, reduce the risk of stroke, heart failure, and heart attacks. All right, that's easy to do. This is a separate study from the Environmental Protection Agency. Quote, taking olive oil may counteract some of the adverse effects of air pollution. This was published in an American Heart Society International conference. Quote, exposure to airborne particulate matter can lead to endothelial dysfunction, a condition in which the endothelium, the inner lining of blood vessels, does not function normally, which is a risk factor for clinical cardiovascular events and progression of atherosclerosis, end quote. The study showed what happens when, in this randomized trial of taking 3 grams a day of olive oil, that's not much oil, it's a small amount, and then they did these sonographic measurements of flow-mediated dilation of the brachioarteriole and found that it was improved with olive oil. Quote, our study suggests that use of olive oil may protect against the adverse vascular effects of exposure to air pollution. That's good. Little exercise and heavy use of electronic media, that means cell phones, that means computers, constitute a significant health risk for children. From University of Eastern Finland, the Physical Activity and Nutrition in Children study carried out by the Institute of Biomedicine shows that low levels of physical activity combined with heavy use of electronic media and sedentary behavior are linked to an increased risk of type 2 diabetes, vascular disease in 6 to 8-year-old children. The study was published in the International Journal of Behavioral Nutrition and Physical Activity, which is a very esteemed journal in the field of exercise and nutrition. So, what does this tell us? It tells us one more piece of the puzzle why we have an epidemic of unhealthy children, overweight, poor hearts, and adult diabetes. We are probably looking at a 10 to 15 year reduction in average life expectancy over the next 30 years when this generation starts to get older because of all these poor living habits. And finally, increasing your fiber intake lowers the risk of premature death in heart attack survivors. This was in the British Medical Journal. This was done at Harvard School of Public Health. And they took a look at 2,258 nurses. And they found that the higher the fiber in your diet, the lower your risk of dying, by as much as 25% from any cause over a 9-year average follow-up. And especially with people suffering from heart attack. So if you've had a heart attack and you increase your fiber, I'm going to suggest 30 to 50 grams a day, then you're less likely to die from a cardiovascular event, as much as 27% versus those that don't. So that's very important. Saving lives. I'm Gary Null. We're talking about a lot of issues today, and finally, juicing up before your workout. Quote, in a world where athletes seem to be juiced too often, the secret to that coveted competitive edge may be as easy as a cup of actual juice. Recent research suggests that depending upon your needs, adding some beetroot juice or tart cherry juice can have a positive effect on your workout. In a presentation at the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, at their annual meeting, this was a paper that was presented. Quote, people are always looking for things that might make them a better athlete or give them a better workout. And they found that the beetroot juice increases nitric oxide, which expands blood vessels and allows for more blood flow through the body. And that's an important aspect of exercise. I would say if you don't have a juicer, but you still want to improve your workout, have an 8-ounce glass of coconut water. That'll give you about 500 milligrams of potassium, and that will make a difference. Also, you could dilute that with about 3 ounces of organic grape juice. Then you get an even better workout. From there to our environmental segment today, genetically modified foods neither safe nor needed, said genetic engineers. This is the latest from GM Watch. Quote, the second edition of GMO Myths and Truths, co-authored by genetic engineers Dr. John Fagan, Dr. Michael Antoniou, and researcher Claire Robinson, was released today. GM foods are neither safe nor needed, and they examined this in great detail. They released a 330-page report, and they go through and debunk all the myths. I'm glad they did. Good for you. So, new information in here, quote, a review that is claimed by pro-GMO lobbyists to show that 1,700 studies show GMO foods are safe, in fact, shows nothing of the sort. Instead, many of the 1,700 articles studied show risk. The review also excludes or glosses over important scientific controversy over GMO safety issues. A review purportedly showing that GM foods are safe on the basis of long-term animal studies in fact shows evidence of risks and uses unscientific double standards to reach a conclusion that is not justified by the data in the actual articles. A laboratory study in human cells shows that very low levels of glyphosate, the main chemical ingredient in Roundup herbicide, which most GM crops are engineered to tolerate, mimic the hormone estrogen and stimulate the growth of breast cancer cells. The level of glyphosate that had this effect was below the level allowed in drinking water in Europe and far below the level allowed in the United States. It was also below the level found in GM glyphosate-tolerant soy, which is imported to Europe for animal feed and human food. If confirmed in animal studies, this finding would overturn regulatory assumptions of safe levels of glyphosate. A rat feeding study by Professor Seriani found toxic effects from GM maize and tiny amounts of Roundup herbicide it was grown with was retracted by a journal editor for unscientific reasons, and yet the study is far stronger and more detailed than many industry studies that are accepted as proof of safety for GMOs. Meaning this, Dr. Seriani and a group of scientists with him used the same model and the same techniques as everyone else studying soy, but they stopped their study 3 months. He allowed the study to go to the end of the lives of the rats, and it was after 3 months that all these tumors began to appear and adverse effects began to show up. So it was published in a peer-reviewed journal. But then a pro-GMO scientist got on the board of the magazine, and they retracted his article. And we're supposed to assume that that's just a coincidence, right? More on that. Then this is the New York Times. And my interest in this is because generally when people are living in denial, they have to, at some point in their reasoning, their logic, their reductionist thinking, they have to separate out potential consequences of being wrong. Now, yesterday I mentioned that there was a study out of Princeton that showed why we never take responsibility, like in a war, for the innocents that we kill, the civilians we kill, or how we will do something that we would immediately call out anyone else for doing. And it's because there's a part of our personality that is fully capable of living in denial of the moral consequences of what we do. So if you take the morality out of your choice, think of all the things you could do that you wouldn't think twice about. That's how people can hurt people, steal from people, betray people, because they no longer are considering what they're doing as an immoral act. It's just they're doing it for whatever their motivation. Now, come back to this point. We are a nation that have so many people living in denial. We are obese, yet we continue to eat the wrong foods. We're suffering from more disease per population. Any group on the planet spending more on this disease is costing us more. And yet, we don't prevent or reverse any of it. We say we want a healthy environment, yet we don't do anything to protect the environment. We say we're against the 1%, and yet look how few people show up at demonstrations to protest it or write letters to protest it. Not even 1% of Americans actively ever protest anything. And listening to Rush Limbaugh or listening to someone else who's protesting on your behalf for their cause isn't the same as you looking at the issues and then in some way engaging in protest, because we disconnect ourselves from the outcome. I call it the Watching Katrina phenomena. Now, what do I mean by that? This program that I do is syndicated all over the world, and it was played down in New Orleans. And when I saw Katrina coming, there was about 5 days that I was saying every day, don't assume what the authorities are telling you correct. I've been in New Orleans many times, and it's below sea level. So if there's a surge in Mr. Big, the man-made canal that goes around New Orleans for the shipping industry, if there's a surge coming in, that's going to go right over into New Orleans, into the lower wards, which it did. If the Corps of Engineers is wrong, and the levees can be breached, there's nothing preventing at least a 10-foot flooding of all the homes. It happened. You can actually see the water marks at between 8 and 10 feet on the houses. And I said, you don't have any generators in the air. The generators are all in the basement. They should be on the roof because that way you're protected. They're in the basements. Your computer system is hooked up to the electric grid, which is almost always underground. All that's going to get turned off. That's exactly what happened. But the point was, people watched it. The vast majority of people chose to stay. Now, I've been down there since filming, and they'll say, well, we believe the authorities. I said, but you, why did you believe the authorities? How often are they wrong? They're wrong all the time. For whatever reason, they chose to stay, and then we watch them on the roofs yelling for help. We will have people who will wait until they can't get any possessions out of it, and their house gets burned down in one of the fires out west. Then you talk with the people and you say, didn't you know there was fires? Yeah. Didn't you know that those fires can, with the Santa Ana winds, can throw sparks, you know, miles away? And suddenly, every place you go is on fire? Yeah. Yeah, we know that. We've seen it. Why didn't you move your important possessions out? I just didn't think it would hit my place. But it did. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to rebuild. But the environment won't change. It's still going to be hot, still going to be fires, still going to be heavy winds, and probably in the future not enough water, unless they take one of the craft and get one of those buckets and bring water in from the ocean. That's a very small amount compared to what it's needed to put out a fire. Well, you know, we're tough. I don't call that tough. Not when you know that you're in harm's way building a house right back on the ocean, living on an earthquake fault, buying a place near a gas hydrofracking or a nuclear power plant. To me, that's not a reasonable choice. So why do we do it? What's in our mind? The only way we can do this is be so conditioned at the same time, detach from likely consequence. So as long as we don't think there's going to be a consequence, we don't look at it. And we should. Now, this is, so when I'm looking at the fact that it is not, are we going to have the oceans rise? It's by how much and how quickly. And no one can accurately answer that. Now, because we've had just in the last week around the world more than 700 exceptional weather events. In fact, just remember 2 weeks ago we had that some of the worst rain in out in Iowa. We've had all these strange things happening. Wouldn't it be wise, if you lived near the water, to now start to look at where else you could move? So you could sell your property while the market is still good, because the vast majority of people, I would say 99.99% of all people, will not change. They just are not going to. They never have. They're not going to. They'll somehow think it will not impact them. They've disconnected from that. So don't be one of the ones who wait, because the waters will rise and it will be overnight. I predict the following. I predict that based upon the sheer weight of the deep ice pack on Iceland, Greenland, I'm sorry, and South Antarctica, you're talking about three glaciers that are huge. How huge? Larger than Texas in Greenland, much larger, and Antarctica larger than France and Greece and Spain. Big. And they're all at angles. Now, they're at such an angle that once they start to melt, which they are, and once they start to break and the barriers that hold them in place are broken, then huge mass is going to go in, and then that will cause other mass behind it to break, and then it'll start a whole cascade. And so you could see several feet rise overnight. And if you want to know how bad that can be, 1 foot increase in sea level would cause 1,000 feet back on shore to be adversely affected. Because remember, you've got not just storm surges, you have tides. You have salt water going in and polluting groundwater and aquifers. So that's what the New York Times is showing. Finally, that after all these years, they're looking at it realistically. But they still haven't spoken with the chaos theorist people who will tell you it could happen at any time. And once it happens, it's going to be a really bad problem. So I'm giving you a heads up on that. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you, I'm Gary Nall. In a few moments, we'll be talking with Dr. Beatrice Edwards. She is the Executive Director and International Program Director for the Government Accountability Project. We're going to talk about the rise of illegal corporate security state and the threats it imposes on democracy and civil rights. She's a graduate of the University of Texas, a doctorate from American University, and she's the author of The Rise of the American Corporate Security State, 6 Reasons to Be Afraid. Her website is whistleblower.org. Dr. Edwards, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm having you on a little early. I've given the introduction to your background and are discussing the illegal corporate security state and the threats it imposes on democracy and civil rights. But prior to that, I wanted to read a few commentaries that actually touch on this very topic in different ways, all right?
Uh-huh.
And then we'll come to you.
All right.
This is from Professor Paul Craig Roberts. And the title of the article, which I'll post on our website, is Militarist Buncombe. Quote, did you know that 90% of war's casualties are non-combatant civilians? That is the conclusion reached by a 9-person research team, and the report's coming out next month in the American Journal of Public Health. The deaths of soldiers who are fighting the war are a small part of the human and economic cost. Clearly, wars are not protecting the lives of civilians. The notion that soldiers are dying for us is false. Non-combatants are the main victims of war. July 4th is America's most important national holiday, celebrating American independence from Great Britain. On July 4th, 1776, America's founding fathers declared that the 13 colonies were no longer colonies, but an independent country in which the rights of Englishmen would prevail for all citizens, and not only for King George's administrators. Actually, the Second Continental Congress voted in favor of independence on July 2nd. In this American assertion of self-determination, citizens of Great Britain were not allowed to vote. Therefore, according to Washington's position on the votes in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, the former Russian terrorists, America's Declaration of Independence was illegitimate and illegal based upon the logic they're using today, based upon what our founding fathers did. Now, on July 4th, all across America, there will be patriotic speeches about our soldiers who gave their lives for their country. To an informed person, these speeches are curious. I'm hard-pressed to think of any examples of our soldiers giving their lives for our country. U.S. Marine Generals Smedley Butler had the same problem. He said that his Marines gave their lives for United Fruit Company's control of Central America. War is a racket, said General Butler, pointing out that U.S. participation in World War I produced 21,000 new American millionaires and billionaires. When General Butler said war is a racket, he meant that war is a racket for a few getting rich on the backs of millions of dead people. According to the article in the American Journal of Public Health, one of the most respected peer-reviewed journals in America, during the 20th century, 119 million deaths could be directly and indirectly related to war. Now, 190 million is 60 million more than the entire U.S. population in the year that I was born. I'm referring to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. The only war fought on U.S. territory was the war against Southern Secession. And Union forces, once they won that war, then were set loose on the plains to destroy the Indians, which they did. Empire over life. That has always been Washington's guiding principle. America's wars have always been fought elsewhere. Cuba, Haiti, Mexico, Philippines, Japan, Germany, Korea, Vietnam, Panama, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Somalia. Washington even attacks countries with which the U.S. is not at war, such as Pakistan and Yemen, and engages in proxy wars. The United States launched 201 overseas military operations between the end of World War II and 2001. Not a single one of these wars and military operations had anything whatsoever to do with defending U.S. population from foreign threats. Except for its wars against the South, the Plains Indians, Haiti, Spain, Panama, Grenada, Mexico, and the U.S. has never won a war. Hard to imagine? It's true. But we won in Japan. Yes and no. You could also argue Japan was defeated by its lack of military resources. Germany was defeated by the Soviet Union. The Allied invasion of Normandy did not occur until June 6, 1944, by which time the Red Army had ground up the German army. When the Allies landed in Normandy, three-fourths of the German army was on the Russian front. The Allied invasion was greatly helped by Germany's shortage of fuel for mobilized units. If Hitler had not allowed hubris to lead him into invading the Soviet Union and instead just set on his European conquests, no Allied invasion would have been possible. Today, Germany would rule all of Europe, including the UK. The U.S. would have no European empire with which to threaten Russia, China, and the Middle East. In Korea in the 1950s, General Douglas MacArthur's victorious over Japan was fought to a standstill by Third World China. In Vietnam, American technological superiority was defeated by a Third World army. The U.S. rolled up mightily in Grenada in the 1980s, but lost its proxy war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Is there anyone foolish to think that Grenada or the Sandinistas were a threat to the United States? Yet, take a look carefully. Like Vietnam Wars were treated as if the fate of the United States hung in the balance. The conflicts produced voluminous, dire predictions and strategic debates. The communist threat replaced the Hitler threat. The American empire was at risk from third world peoples. Dominoes would fall everywhere. But they didn't. Washington orchestrated a coup that overthrew the elected government, corrupt as it was, in Ukraine, and installed a stooge government. Washington's stooges began issuing threats against Russia and Russia-speaking populations in Ukraine. These threats resulted in those parts of the Ukraine that were formerly part of Russia declaring their independence. Washington blames Russia, not itself, in a stirring the pot, demonizing Russia and recreating the Cold War with military deployments in the Baltics and Eastern Europe. Washington needs to reinvent the Cold War in order to justify the hundreds of billions of dollars that Washington annually feeds the military security complex, some of which recycles the political campaign donations. In contrast to Washington's propaganda, an honest view of the events in Ukraine has yet to be presented in any of the mainstream media. In the United States, patriotism and militarism have become synonymous. This July 4th, find the courage to remind the militarists that Independence Day celebrates the Declaration of Independence, not the American Empire. The Declaration of Independence was not only a declaration of independence from King George III, but also a declaration of independence from unaccountable, tyrannical government. The oath of office commits the U.S. office holder to the defense of the U.S. Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. In the 21st century America, worst enemies are not Al-Qaeda, Iran, Russia, and China. America's worst enemies are our own presidents who have declared repeatedly that the orchestrated war on terror gives them the right to set aside civil liberties guaranteed to every citizen in the United States by our Constitution. Presidential disrespect for the U.S. Constitution is so extreme that Obama has nominated David Barron to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. Barron is the Justice Department official who wrote the memos fabricating a legal justification for the office of president to murder U.S. citizens without due process of law. Having stripped U.S. citizens of their civil liberties, executive branch agencies are now stocking up on vast amounts of ammunition, and the Department of Agriculture has placed an order for submachine guns. The Department of Homeland Security has acquired 2,717 mine-resistant armored personnel carriers for the United States. Congress and the media are not interested in why the executive branch is arming itself so heavily against the American people. During the entirely unusual century that we just went through, have we learned no lesson? The illegitimate power asserted by the office of the president is not only a threat to every American, but also to every living being on the planet. Approximately 17,300 nuclear weapons are presently deployed in at least 9 countries, many of which can be launched and reach their targets within 45 minutes. It only takes one fool, and Washington has thousands of fools, and all life on Earth would be challenged. The neoconservative belief that the United States is the exceptional, indispensable country chosen by history to rule the Earth is a belief full of arrogance and hubris that will lead to war. Keep your likely fate in mind as you watch the military bands and marches. That's the end of quote from him. Now, one final quick one. This is from Mr. Escobar in Tom Dispatch. Quote, consider this. Our advanced robotic creatures, those drone aircraft, grimly named Predators and Reapers, are still blowing away human beings from Yemen to Pakistan. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is now testing a 14,000-pound drone advanced enough to take off and land on its own deck of an aircraft carrier. No human pilot needed. Oh, but it costs $1.4 billion. Now, while we're talking about the skies, Who could forget that the U.S. military is committed to buying 2,400 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters and the most expensive weapons system in history? The bill, $400 billion. Let me repeat that, $400 billion. Or twice what it cost to put a man on the moon. In similar fashion, the U.S. Navy, with 10 aircraft carriers afloat on a planet on which no other nation has more than two, is now building a new class of supercarriers. The first will be the USS Gerald Ford. It's due to delivery next in 2 years at a cost of $12 billion, and it's experiencing, of course, overruns and performance problems. In the meantime, Washington has dispatched one of its combat ships, a troubled $34 billion weapons system, to Singapore. And so it goes. And Congress just coughed up $69 million for a new prison in Guantanamo for 15 high-value prisoners. Similarly, when it comes to the infrastructure needed to listen in on the world, the sky's the limit, including an almost $2 billion data center built for the National Security Agency in Buffdale, Utah. In such infrastructural realms, the U.S. is today without serious competition. On the other hand, if we're talking about purely civilian infrastructure, just consider that at this very moment, Congress is dilly-dallying while the crucial highway trust fund that keeps American roads and interstates in shape is headed off the cliff and projected to go bankrupt in August. This from the country that once turned the car into a poetic symbol of freedom. Meanwhile, the nation's overall infrastructure, from levees and dams to wastewater and aviation, now regularly gets a grade D from the American Society for Civil Engineers. So as a rising power in the 19th century, the U.S. moved towards global status on the basis of an ambitious program of canal building and then government-sponsored transcontinental railroads. Jump a century and a half, and the country that until recently was being called the planet's sole superpower has yet to build not a single mile of high-speed rail. Not one. Even a prospective line between Los Angeles and San Francisco, which looked like it might get constructed, is now being told no. So, talk about priorities. Those are misplaced priorities. Now, over to you. Do you begin to see some of the connections between what you're doing and what the people you represent do, and the problems of a government that seems to have lost its sense of priorities?
Well, yes. I think it's very interesting, some of the points you bring up, particularly with respect to the U.S. Constitution and how far the executive branch of government has departed from the principles of the Constitution. And when you were talking, I was thinking about some of the motivations for the way the U.S. Constitution was constructed, and that was there is an amendment to the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, that prohibits the government from executing general warrants for search and seizure. And this was a provision that was inserted because the colonists were routinely subjected to house-to-house searches by the British government in search of a taxable activity. And so our Constitution guarantees that the government may only execute individualized warrants based on probable cause. That is, you must be suspected of something in order for the government to search your belongings and seize your property. And what the NSA now does, and the NSA is, of course, part of the executive branch, is it executes general warrants. So the government may use wholesale surveillance to seize information about all citizens in direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. And this is a very alarming development. And coupled with that is it is a costly development. And as you pointed out, it is that money that is spent in order to realize this capability is paid to private corporations that develop that capability and hand it over to the government or execute it themselves.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. I'd like for you to address one of the greatest dangers to American civil liberties and rights, and that is the coming together of the government and private industry surveillance programs and embarking on their own agenda. And this is after 9/11, and we've had guests and experts on the program who have argued that the so-called war on terror is a broadly over-exaggerated storyline that has sunk into the collective consciousness of the nation. And like many superstitions based upon fear, it, however, has had a debilitating effect upon the national psyche and has enabled private corporations and their government supporters to reap huge wealth and control over the lives of millions of people. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think a couple of things that are related to the points you bring up. One is the war on terror and the prolonging of this fear of attack. After 9/11, of course, all of us were afraid this could happen again. Maybe this could become a daily or monthly occurrence. Maybe there was some kind of organization out there with the institutional capability to do this to us repeatedly. And the government played on that fear and kept that fear going, has kept it going for years. Now, why would the U.S. government do this? And I think you, in a way, supplied the answer, because when people are afraid of attack, they will much more readily surrender their rights in order to feel safer, and they will put up with a great deal more secrecy than they would under ordinary circumstances. And so we see both things happening. We've been told by our president, the constitutional scholar, that we have to balance our privacy rights against the security that the government may provide. But really, what he's talking about is not a debate that weighs privacy versus security. It's a debate about democracy versus tyranny. And our constitutional scholar president is presenting this debate to us as an argument that like-minded people might engage in as a reasonable discussion. And it isn't that at all. That shows how far the executive branch of government has gone in convincing people that we must put up with invasive corporate and government conduct in order to feel secure. And then, as you point out, this kind of fear allows government and corporate cooperation in a way that appropriates a greater and greater amount of the national wealth for purposes of so-called defense, like wholesale surveillance of the American population. If you look at the consumers of national security agency data, which the NSA was obliged to release in the wake of the disclosures about their conduct, you'll see that the agencies that were actually in inspecting data collected by the NSA were not so much Homeland Security and the Defense Department as the U.S. Trade Representative and the Agriculture Department, the agencies of government that liaise most closely with the private sector. And the question about why is there no mass reaction? Why is there no demonstrating in the streets about this? It is because the government corporate complex has so weakened our ability to resist that we don't have that organized capacity anymore. Our trade unions are very, very weak, and what we're reduced to is a dependence on whistleblowers, that the single individuals in a given bureaucracy, government agency, corporation who are taking it upon themselves at the risk of their profession, their personal lives, their careers, their finances, to expose the illegal and unconstitutional conduct of the government or of a corporation. And there you have Edward Snowden, a single whistleblower who is now in exile, subject to prosecution under the Espionage Act by the U.S. Justice Department. Excuse me.
I only have time for one more question here. Look at Verizon and Google and Facebook and Amazon and others, the multinational telecoms. Then look at Booz Allen and Science Applications International Corporation, a $4 billion private IT firm that almost exclusively provides high-tech service to the government for surveillance. Courts can now unconstitutionally seize our private data without regard of whether there's a cause or reason for suspected criminal activity. And yet the real criminals, they would have known about. They would have known about all the drug money being laundered through the banks. They would have known about all the liar loans. They would have known about all the criminal activity that was communicated that would later come out in trials. And yet they never go after these people. And yet industrial espionage has been rampant for a long time, where people were collecting data using governmental agencies and then giving it to select people within the corporate system. And yet we don't think there's anything unusual about that. So once they wanted to know what books we took out of a library, why should they know? It's none of their business what I want to read or you want to read. What movies you watch on television. Why? There wasn't an outcry until one day that was no longer important. And now I'm saying that we've adapted to the idea of fear and control by them, that I'm very concerned that we are nothing more than a fascistic state controlled by a relatively small group of extremely powerful corporations. And the people we see out front, these are merely the opinion leaders to make this Kool-Aid seem refreshing. Final thoughts.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, we did have a whistleblower specifically about SAIC and its boondoggle surveillance project. Employee Thomas Drake of the National Security Agency, who exposed the fact that SAIC was proposing a $3.5 billion dragnet surveillance program to the NSA, and the NSA had at its disposal an in-house $300 million program that would have been more effective and legal. It shut down the in-house program and opted for the SAIC program. So there's money in conducting wholesale surveillance like that. And the other thing is the kind of lulling of the American population into a state of acceptance of wholesale surveillance. Somebody was saying, you know, Americans tend to shrug about the collection of their data and say, well, I'm not a terrorist, so I don't care if the government is looking at my information. But really, if you think about that, if you're saying that, I don't care because I'm not a terrorist, you really haven't thought about it long enough. Because if the government has everybody under wholesale surveillance, that means we have no free press anymore. We don't have an independent judiciary anymore. Our Congress is captive. As you say, it's turnkey totalitarianism. The infrastructure is there to simply eliminate all of the rights that were once enshrined in the U.S. Constitution.
Unless you're a good corporate Democrat, in which case, get in line, stick out your hand, someone's going to put some money in it. And we've seen that. That's why this administration is deeply, and the Clinton administration is deeply defective in its philosophy about being populist. It's not populist at all. You're doing good work out there, and the book is The Rise of the American Corporate Security State, 6 Reasons to Be Afraid, website whistleblower.org. We look forward to another conversation. In fact, I'm going to invite you back for an hour conversation to go into a lot of these in detail in our Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much, Beatrice Edwards, for being on with us today.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to another interview.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow.